Well, good morning and welcome to the United Lodge of Theosophists in here in Philadelphia on our Sunday morning meeting here at the Lodge. Let's remember here during the pandemic or since the pandemic, we still continue to do these Zoom meetings and we're very fortunate to be able to do so that it can be more inclusive so that even more people can join in with these meetings. But let's remember a few particulars about Zoom etiquette that in our meetings, all the meetings, not just Zoom, we make every effort to maintain an air of anonymity and refrain from using names, et cetera. And we ask that there not be crosstalk whenever questions or contributions are offered, that they are offered to the chairperson when called upon, please. So these are traditions that are designed for everybody, to welcome everybody to the study of theosophy, to participate in the discussion and the questions without distractions of personal differentiations or social distinctions, et cetera. We will now read the declaration of the United Lodge of Theosophists, and this declaration simply is a statement of purposes for which the United Lodge is established. The policy of this lodge is independent devotion to the cause of theosophy without professing attachment to any theosophical organization. It is loyal to the great founders of the theosophical movement, but does not concern itself with dissensions or differences of individual opinion. The work it has on hand and the end it keeps in view are too lofty to leave it the time or inclination to take part in side issues. That work and that end is the dissemination of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of theosophy and the exemplification in practice of those principles through a truer realization of the self, a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. It holds that the unassailable basis for union among theosophists, wherever or however situated, is similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching, and therefore has neither constitution, bylaws, nor officers, the sole bond between its associates being that basis. And it aims to disseminate this idea among theosophists in the furtherance of unity. It regards as theosophists, all who are engaged in the true service of humanity, without distinction of race, creed, sex, condition, or organization. And it welcomes to its association all those who are in accord with its declared purposes and who desire to fit themselves, by study and otherwise, to be the better able to help and teach others. The true theosophist belongs to no cult or sect, yet belongs to each and all. Now, to carry out the purposes of the declaration, here in Philadelphia, the lodge carries on 3 meetings per week. On a Sunday morning, such as now, our meeting is from 11 a.m. to 12 noon. It's held here at Theosophy Hall and online, as you well know. And from 11 to 12, and it covers broad theosophical topics. Each is a different topic each week. And each month it takes on a certain theme. So the Sunday talks have a theme this month of universal theosophy. And this is the final week of October. So the title of this presentation is Fundamental Principles of Theosophy. And it will be presented as a panel discussion between two volunteer students. Now, also on Wednesday, we have a roundtable discussion, which is strictly a Zoom meeting. Roundtable is Friday from 6:30 to 7:30. And we're beginning a new series this Friday. It's called Western Occultism. And there are a number of articles associated in this series, which will be emailed to the group in the next few days. So that's on Fridays from 5:30 to 6:30. And then, of course, 6:30 to 7:30. Thank you. 6:30 to 7:30. And then on Wednesdays from 7:30 to 8:45, we have our study class in the Ocean of Theosophy. So let's bear in mind, the United Lodge of Theosophists is financially sustained entirely by voluntary contributions. Its activities depend similarly on voluntary offerings of time and work. All are invited to participate, but there is no obligation imposed or implied. So we have our panel discussion today, and the first part of the panel discussion will be a broad presentation to throw out a few ideas there regarding ethics and a practical approach of using what we learn and understand about theosophy. And one thing that's helpful to remember is that, generally speaking, there's no difference in the ethics, we are told, of all the religions that are worthy of being called religion in the world. The teachings tell us that the very reason why people inherently adhere to their religious traditions is because of the truth they understand about the ethics of the religion. These common religious ethics make for happiness, they make for progress, ethics make for law and order. And they are perceived, real ethics are perceived as true by the inner man. Now, as regards ethics, from whichever tradition one comes, the difference among folks is what the source of the ethics is. Some would say the source of ethics is God, others would say it's from a certain prophet or reformer, etc. So the question is, are they actually commands of an outside authority? That's the question that the student of theosophy asks. This is one of the big differences between religion as regards ethics and theosophy, not that the ethics themselves are different, but what's the source of the ethics? Theosophy tells us and helps us to understand better that ethics are actually recognized by the inner man as a matter of universal law or natural law or spiritual law, whatever words we would want to use, but it's a matter of law. And so the idea is that this world is ruled not by a god or not by a reformer, but by law. And it's because of law that the theosophist recognizes ethics in the world. And we seek to strive to understand the principles and operations of law in mundane life. Fundamentally speaking, in the light of theosophy, ethics is an expression of the natural law. So the one source of ethics, which is the source of all wisdom, which is the source of all fundamental principles, is man himself. There is a compelling power within man that accepts this essential idea. And this power is the essential nature of man himself. We all have the same essential nature, and that nature, in essence, is one with the universal oversoul. So one may be convinced that the moral law must be obeyed. And the thing is, in a practical way, even if we're approaching it from a selfish perspective, we'll give an example. We know, for instance, generally speaking, that evil done in this life will be met with sure punishment in another reincarnation. So working with the law, one may think to himself, well, then I'm just not going to do evil in this life, and that way it'll lessen my burden in my next incarnation. And that would not be wrong. That would not be a wrong approach. If a man works harder at his job and more efficiently because he decides he wants to earn more money in order to help those who are dependent on him, This is not selfish. This is working with the law of cause and effect. However, the theosophist, with the study of theosophy, adds a little more to just that. And that the idea is that, yes, whatever work you're going to do, whatever service that we're going to perform, however virtuous we're going to live our lives, don't be virtuous because the religious leader tells us to. Typically, it's not going to last. It's not going to last. The question why is there. And the answer comes because under the law of karma and reincarnation, virtue has to prevail. So virtue at work, for instance, is yes, if you want to earn more, work harder, but while you're doing it, share these ideas with others and be of service to help people understand the value of being virtuous. And we come eventually to learn that really virtue is necessary regardless of whether there's something in it for me. But to work, anyway, so true religion and true sciences, true religion and true sciences aspects or complementary aspects of the one truth. So we read in the Secret Doctrine that the synthesis of science, religion, and philosophy is what theosophy is. And it gives a scientific basis on why it's important to live a virtuous life. It gives a scientific basis on why it's important to live an ethical life. There's no bishop or priest in theosophy that tells you you have to do it, but there is a teaching that gives us insight as to why to do it, and the opportunity is there for us to learn the teaching and come to understand and naturally live our lives along a virtuous ethical path. So we're going to stop right there. And these are some fundamental ideas we wanted to get started with. We're going to pass it to our next panelist, who's going to take give some more practical applications of it.
So we just heard ideas in regards to practical theosophy. And what we're going to focus on is the declaration of the United Lodge of Theosophists, because the ideas in the declaration are not just necessarily specific for theosophists. These are ideas that are global in scope. They are practical, they're spiritual. Anybody reading the declaration would be able to do what is suggested. So we're not going to read it again. But here at Theosophy Hall, we do read it at every single meeting. And the declaration is what binds all the ULTs together. Even though each lodge is independent in its expression of the declaration, in regards to how the meetings are run, what the topics are. Like here at Theosophy Hall, we have panels, lectures, and forums, but that may not be the case at, say, the New York Lodge. But the bond that is between all the lodges comes from the declaration. And it's a unification tool that we use. We just have a short quote from, it's the sources of the ULT declaration. And it's from Theosophical Movement, volume 40, page 315. And it says that the name United Lodge of Theosophists was a phrase used by Mr. Judge. The idea is also stated in the message he sent on behalf of the American Theosophists to the Convention of the European Theosophists in 1895. And he quotes, "Let us then press forward together in the great work of the real theosophical movement, which is aided by working organizations, but is above them all. We will then each and all be members of the Universal Lodge of Free and Independent Theosophists, which embrace every friend of the human race." So Mr. Judge was one of the contributors to the declaration. Mr. Crosby used ideas. He actually wrote it up. He used ideas from HBB and from Mr. Judge. Many statements that we see in the declaration are found in HPB's five messages to the American Theosophists. And HPB wrote these messages as an outline of theosophical work. But as we said, many of these ideas can be used by anyone in everyday life. So there are a few main points in the declaration, which are also fundamental principles of the philosophy. And most of it has to do about spread broadcasting, the best way to spread broadcast these ideas. And one of them is independent devotion to the cause of theosophy. And these are devotions to the original teachings laid down, not what has been colored in today's religions in regards to dogma and ritual. We focus totally on the original teachings as they were presented to HPB by her teachers. And one of those, another main point, is independent devotion to the original teachings and loyalty to the great founders of the movement. And those great founders are not necessarily HPB and Mr. Judge. The great founders are the adepts, the teachers, the elder brothers, and it is they who have assisted HPB in putting these ideas in writing for us all. And another idea that is in the declaration talks about without distinction of race, creed, sex, condition, or organization. And it's, we don't, because we welcome anyone, the idea is because we're welcoming and inclusive despite the differences. We stress the idea of not being concerned with dissensions. We each do our own work. We each do, as I said, our own thing. And it should be honored, the effort that people are putting into their studies, coming to meetings, even in the mundane areas of life. Maybe somebody isn't, you know, making a meal exactly the way we like it, but we have to honor the effort that has been put into it. In our jobs, the same thing. honor the effort that somebody is putting in when they're trying to do their work. We want to read from five messages. This is from the end of the first message. But to work properly in our great cause, it is necessary to forget all personal differences of opinion as to how the work is to be carried on. This is HPB speaking. Let each of us work in his own way and not endeavor to force our ideas of work upon our neighbors. So in regards to putting out, spread, broadcasting these ideas, we each study differently. We each, we arrange our talks, our lectures, our presentations individually. But the whole aim is to put forth and spread broadcast to everyone these teachings. These are the basis for all the fundamental ideas in other religions. And another part in the message says, thus then, quote, union is strength. And for every reason, private differences must be sunk in united work for our great cause. So the whole idea then in these fundamental principles, this is one of the main ones, that union, despite diversity that is in all of our meetings, must the differences that we bring in from the outside should be left at the door, and we just focus on the philosophy and honoring that spirit that is within us all that brought us here so that we can spread these ideas out into the world. So universal brotherhood is mentioned in the declaration. And one of the things that needs to be understood is that these dissensions that might come up, it is the dissensions that can prevent us from putting forth this idea of universal brotherhood. So anyone who is spiritually working to help others, no matter what their belief system is, if they are focusing on just helping without expecting anything in return, they are a theosophist no matter what their religion is. And it is said, the last sentence of the declaration, the true theosophist belongs to no cult or sect, yet belongs to each and all. So in that respect, we welcome all, as was said, unity in diversity. The dissensions need to be kept out so that we can focus on spread broadcasting the ideas in regards to universal brotherhood. Another interesting piece from the five messages, also from the first message, HPB says, theosophists are of necessity the friends of all movements in the world, whether intellectual or simply practical, for the amelioration of the condition of mankind. This says it all right here. Friends of all movements, simply practical, and it's the amelioration of the condition of mankind. And even though we aren't organized, because as we said, we're all functioning differently, you won't see the same person up here all the time. We don't have a leader. We all function as one. We are unified in that. So even though the ULT is not organized, it states that the bond is similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching, and we are trusting in the higher self to guide us from the higher mind. If that is done, the path for all will be clear. So we have finished two different aspects of looking at the fundamental principles of theosophy. And we will now take any questions. And we have one from Theosophy Hall.
It's our understanding that the ULT is organized, and very much so, although it is not an organization per se. If it were not organized, this meeting would maybe start at 11:35. You know, there'd be no topic, it would be free flow. It would be anarchy, and it's not. It's far from it. That's our contribution.
Right, we think that the speaker used that word, is not organized. Perhaps she meant to say is not an organization per se. The emphasis being on the United, ULT is an association of independent students. And yes, we are an organized association with a very definite procedures, with a certain level of tradition. And we do what is necessary to carry on the work as it has been passed on to us. So do we continue to pass it on to others who see that it's important. And there's, and we have our methods and means of doing that. Yes. In the ULT.
And we heard mention the five messages. Five messages to whom? Is there more to that? Is there more of a context to that?
Well, we did mention in the beginning that it was five messages from HPB to the American Theosophists. And we did want to comment on the idea of organization. If one looks at the ULT globally, we are not organized the same way. Each ULT does have the opportunity to function and make their meetings as they wish, but it's not like what we are going to study this week, the one in England is going to study the same way. Their meetings are set up differently. So in the global sense, we are not organized. But each unit, as was said, each ULT has to be organized into some respect. But as was said, we don't have a president, but there are people who help to organize the meetings so that what you see here and presented is coherent.
SL.
In line what was just said about organizing, we've had mentioned in the declaration the spread broadcast of the fundamental principles, but also every other Wednesday we have a presentation of the three fundamentals. And we think sometimes it's confused. Is there a difference between a principle and a proposition? If so, what is that difference?
So the question is there a difference between a principle and a proposition? Well, if we just look at the word proposition, a proposition is an idea which is known to be true by the person proposing it. So when we talk about the three fundamental propositions of theosophy, these are three ideas that we offer out to the public that give a universal basis for a system of thought the ancient system of thought that we know as theosophists. And the idea is that if one considers these three propositions, then when they study the philosophy and as they live their lives, they will be able to understand what's going on around them and understand the ideas and the philosophy, because if they're using the propositions as a basis for thinking. But the point is, it has to be tried to be found to be true. It's not expected to be believed. It's not a dogma that one is expected to recite. So that's an idea of a proposition, something that is known to be true and where we can invite people to test it for themselves. Now, a fundamental principle, that would be different. A principle is a basis for action. It's a basis for living and a basis for action. So if we look at, you know, what is a fundamental principle, it's a way of living one's life. And when we talk about the higher principles, that would be a matter of, you know, the more universal ideas that we live by that help us to see life more inclusively and conclusively, to help us draw reasonable answers to the great questions of life, such as reincarnation and karma. Any contributions? Yeah. Uh-huh. Yes, MDW.
In your presentation of ethics, you mentioned that all the world religions propagate some kind of ethical foundation. And that's really looking outside of ourselves. So where would we find these divine ethics, and how would we find them?
Right. So the teaching as regards ethics then is that the difference between theosophy and world religions is that the source of the ethics is not outside of ourselves. The source of ethics is our own essential nature. So if we look at the word ethics, in large part, could we, yeah, thanks. The word ethics can be seen as one's relation with and how one operates in harmony with or in disharmony with the rest of the world, with life around him or her. Now, what that means to a student of theosophy is, well, where do we start then? If the source of ethics is in our own essential nature, then really we start with the cooperation and harmony that we have within our own nature, our own individual personal ethic. What is the ethic between Arjuna and Krishna within ourselves? And we might find that in different times of the day or in different times of our life, or even in different times of the year. We may or may not be more in harmony with ourselves. And that can find expression in our relationships with others, in certain decisions that we make. So if we want to affect the relationships with others, if we want to affect the world around us, then best to go back to our own internal nature and find out where the disharmony is, where the abruption is in one's own individual ethic. And that's the first step in bringing greater harmony to the world around us. So the true source of ethic is our own essential nature. And as we said in the talk, we all have the same essential nature, and that essential nature is we are one with the very oversoul of the universe, which is the source of ethic. Now, there's a, please.
Another thing we need to look at in regards to ethics is that some people may think that one religion has ethics that maybe don't seem very ethical. So over the course of time, when we look at the idea of true ethics, those ethics are those that have remained from the beginning of time until now, and they don't change. They don't change in regards to the culture. They don't change in regards to the person. Whatever situation is happening, these ethics remain the same. And what had just been stated, that these are internal expressions, is that back in the beginning of this period of evolution, we were impressed by the elder brothers with certain inherent tendencies. And part of it were these true ethics, and they are embedded in Bodhi. So that if we can remain open spiritually to our higher nature, then that those true ethics will come through, and we can express them from our spiritual nature.
In Theosophy Hall, we have a contribution.
So, did HPB give any specific messages to, say, the English or the Indian theosophists, of which there were many and still are? Or did she address the American theosophist only directly? And why? Why just the American theosophists?
So the question is, did HPB direct questions or messages, direct messages to theosophists, particular groups all over the world, or only to the American theosophists? Our understanding is, first and foremost, that theosophy is not directed toward any one culture, civilization, group. It is put in the world for a reason, for to assist, to aid, to be a resource for all of mankind. And that's why it was put, that's why it was founded in New York, which was a power center at the time. And it's why it's written in English, which apparently it was going to, English was known to become the most widely recognized world religion. So the point is, it's not in particular for any one country. Now, those five messages to the American theosophists, we'll put that out to the group. Our understanding is that those five messages were simply written to the convention that was held in America 5 years in a row, not necessarily because they're Americans, they get this message, but we could be completely wrong. Any contributions here? Yes, SL, please.
We think probably one difference would be that HPB resided for an extended period of time in India, in the Theosophical Society headquarters. People came from all over. They had direct contact with her. She could speak with them directly. And the same way in England. There was a Blavatsky Lodge. She was there. She could answer questions. In terms of her experience for direct contact with theosophists, it was relatively limited, maybe to just a couple of years and to a very limited number of people in America. And so not having that advantage of direct contact with her, while she communicated all over the world by letter, it perhaps was necessary for her to give some more direct written or read communication and guidance to those working actively in America.
Thank you. Yes, here in the lecture.
Well, we were wondering that since the new sub-race of the current root race is developing here in the Americas, that she wanted to provide an impulse, an extra lift, as it were, and encouragement to the souls that have gravitated to the Americas.
Certainly in one of her messages, she gave a heads up to let the Americans know that They are, quote unquote, a new race that's being formed for the time being, and that we would see within the race that there'll be an inclination for what she says, for the psychic to outrun the monastic, or in other words, for our personal desire nature to gain control over our intellectual or spiritual-intellectual nature. And that was a warning, because things are changing. This is a time of transition. And that was very definitely directed as an issue that was going on in America at the time, and that would continue to go on in the centuries coming forward.
And she had asked Mr. Judge to, in the United States, to form different ULTs here in the United States to spread broadcast these ideas. And as was just said, in regards to, it is in the, not what we can't say that it's in the United States. She said in the Americas, that this new amalgamation will occur. So it will be these messages. She was giving hope and instruction to the people here in the United States to assist them and to let them know the importance of what is going on here. And as was said, you know, New York, it was a hub, and it just seemed natural to present these ideas in New York City.
It's also it's helpful to bear in mind that while all this was going on and the time that she spent in Asia and in Europe, Mr. Judge was still here in the Americas, and she made it clear to us that that he is the only other direct messenger from the School of Masters. Or actually, she used the word, he is the only other direct agent, Mr. Judge. So they worked hand in hand. Everything they did, everything they wrote was complementary with each other. As such, the philosophy of theosophy is one, as recorded in the writings of Mr. Judge and H.P. Blavatsky. Yes, S.L., and then another in all. Yeah.
In listening to the comments about the source of ethics, it would seem then that even if a one believes that an outside God revealed these ethics, or a savior or prophet is the source of ethics, unless they fervently recognize within themselves the truth of that, they would not lead an ethical life. It would be a very superficial belief. And we could also fairly say, to the extent they believe the truth of that ethic in themselves, to that extent, they believe in the person who taught it to be real and genuine. So ultimately, it all must come from within.
Thank you. So the source is, rather the contribution here is, even if the ethic is a good ethic and it's right and true, if it is said to come from an outside authority, that is a false religious teaching. And because of that, eventually the individual comes to ask why. You know, why? He comes, he takes pause. Why should I be virtuous? Why? Because God tells me to be? Well, I didn't really hear him say that. However, if the philosophical, theosophical idea is presented in terms of the individual's own divine nature, then he can find the answers within himself if he also comes to learn and understand about karma and reincarnation and his own higher self. So when it's presented as part of a system of truth, then one doesn't have to believe it because they're told to believe it. They'll recognize it and know that it's true. This is the idea. And yes, JCS, please. Okay. What?
No. Well, extending that thought process, we come to the realization that in the United Lodge of Theosophists, there are propositions offered. There's an effort to educate, draw all the participants so that everything is based on not outside legislation, not outside indoctrination, but rather the entire process is based on the role of intuition and self-development, self-evolution.
Thank you. So the point is really, it's a matter of learning and growing in certain ways to develop one's own intuition to be able to see the truth of the idea. Now, an idea that is true when planted in the mind will continue to grow to be true. So if this idea of the, you know, an outside God says this because it's true, it's never really going to be able to take root. The power to which it has over another individual is a function of everybody else outside who believes that. But the true idea grows in power because the power is inherent in the true idea. And the idea here is that at ULT, in Theosophy generally, the hope and the work is to learn, to grow, and to develop intuitionally to be able to recognize the truth of ideas and to be able to recognize false ideas when they're presented.
And the whole idea is learning to listen to your intuition. Because if we're constantly looking outward at materialism and, you know, is what somebody says true? And we have to listen, we have to hear what is going on in our hearts and try and release those impressions that were imprinted at the beginning of evolutions, this evolutionary period, so that we do know the true ethics.
Yes, in the hall.
conscience and intuition, the same, different, or related? Are they or not? Is it the same thing as someone that said that we have a conscience, it's our inner voice? Is that the same as intuition, or is...
The question is conscience, and what's the distinction between conscience and intuition, or is it the same thing? And intuition actually is an inherent aspect of our own higher nature. It's an aspect of buddhi, as is will, as is compassion. Conscience, on the other hand, is something we wonder, you know, it's with knowledge, conscience, and it might have something to do with more perfunctory issues like, I've probably been here, done that before. It's probably best to handle it in this way. We're trying to get a distinction between the two.
We think that conscience is maybe more of a lower
mental process,
a lower mental, you know, lower mind. But we think that conscience, if it is prompted by buddhi, by intuition, it can be raised up to a higher level and be able to make a different decision based on that conscience being prompted by buddhi.
Any other contributions along this line? SL has his hand up.
We have heard the distinction described this way, that conscience comes through our awareness as a feeling, a warning that we should do not do something. Or if we have done it, a feeling that we did the wrong thing. We're not sure why, but it's a feeling. Whereas intuition is a direct knowledge of what to do, what not to do, what is the heart of the matter, without any necessary private or previous experience that we can draw upon in this life or reasoning it out. It's just knowing what to do. It's wisdom, basically, that comes from our nature.
Thank you. So to recap that, then, conscience is more of a feeling about what to do or what not to do, or more of a feeling about what I have done, whether I should have or should not have. And that is different from intuition, which is a direct knowing of what is the right thing to do in the moment, just knowing it without taking premise to conclusion. It's just a matter of direct knowledge. JCS, please.
Yeah, the use of premise to conclusion is what occurred to this student, that if we have this feeling, the hair on the back of our neck goes up, it could even be a physical feeling, we still are rooted in that premise to conclusion, the use of logic, the use of lower mind, whereas the intuition is as a flash. It's direct cognition. There's no intermediate anxious kind of pondering over something. The wisdom is right there.
Thank you. So then the question comes, how does one discern between what his conscience, is it conscience speaking with to him, or is it intuition speaking to him? How does one discern the difference between the two? Any ideas? Yes, SL?
It would seem that intuition can always be checked and verified by our understanding of principles. And that is why we study the fundamental principles, to give our minds, our reasoning powers, the ability to check, test, and verify the intuition, because we have to do that. Otherwise, our intuitions could be colored by our personal nature.
Thank you. So the contribution has to do with, there may well be people who think they're using their intuition and it's not their intuition. It could be their personal desires, but they'll call it their intuition. So probably be careful about someone who brags about how developed their intuition is, right? And one thing about, as was said, one thing about intuition is, in the end, one can reflect on what the situation was. And always, when it was intuition at work, one can follow the whole process as a logical process that all made sense in the end, even though in the moment, you may not have known why it was right, but you just knew it was right.
There's a chat.
Okay, there's a contribution, there's a chat here. Let's see if we can do. Question, what is the difference between conscience and consciousness?
Conscience and consciousness, aren't they the same?
Any contributions, ideas, the difference between conscience and consciousness? Yes, here in Theosophy Hall.
Well, conscience is, you know, it's that warning. Some people seem to be able to ignore it, or allegedly there are those that are sociopaths that have no conscience. But consciousness is something we all have. It's in all kingdoms. It's a matter of degree. With the lighting up of Manus, humanity has self-reflective consciousness. So consciousness is everywhere. It's universal. But conscience, an animal, in a sense, doesn't have a conscience because it knows how to act under its own conditions, and it does not act counter to its, in a way, the way they're programmed, we could say.
Instincts, yes.
Mm-hmm. So we think that's one aspect, at least.
Thank you.
Yeah, when we think of the idea of consciousness, you know, like humans are self-conscious, and as was said, the lower kingdoms are have consciousness to a lesser degree. They are not lit up. They are not self-conscious. We spoke about going from, you know, thinking about whatever it is that I do, we can think through and see how it will probably end. Animals are not able to think from premise to conclusion. They just act, as was said just now, in regards to what level they are at this moment. And conscience, we've been talking about, is that idea of the idea of good or bad, usually. But then people have different ideas of what is good and what is bad. So
we yes, have, in Theosophy Hall?
Yes.
And Theosophy is a guide to help us to perfect ourselves, that we are not poor, miserable sinners, but we are, in fact, gods in potential that have not realized our potentiality yet. Whereas the elder brothers and the adepts have perfected their human nature. And they will not act counter to the law. They're one with the law. So they would never, I mean, it would be absurd. It's just, you know, they've been through our state. They've evolved and they're helping us now, mainly behind the scenes. So there's that other state of perfected humanity where Manus is fully lit and where one would not act counter to the laws. And they can't act counter to the laws to help us when they would like to. They have to witness our bumbling and stumbling and our ineptitude and our avarice and whatnot until we learn the lessons. They can't intervene. It wouldn't help us in the long run anyway.
Thank you. Yes, JCS.
And that needed wisdom of when and how to help is where our practice of altruism comes in, because it's by trial and effort of trying to figure out where's the line between empowering the other to develop on their own or enabling, doing everything for them contrary to law so that the lessons never learned. We're in the process of getting information about that.
SL?
It's been said that that wisdom is impacted in our nature. So ultimately, if we ask ourselves questions, we should be able to figure it out for ourselves if that knowledge is within. But on the other hand, we're told that, we really can't pursue this path ultimately without the help and guidance of others who have gone before, someone who can teach and help us. So is there a guide? Is there a principle by when we can decide when and how to ask a question? To what extent do we try to search for within ourselves? And when do we ask for help from others in the search for truth?
So how do we then? We should be able to know when we have a problem and we're thinking about it, we can't really come to a conclusion. It is also said that at night before we go to bed, if we have a problem that we're working on, to think about it, because as we know, at night, the soul is kind of free to work on its own plane. And that at night, with this problem, we are free to, we're free to experience what the soul is about, but most of the time we're not able to bring it back, that answer. But the thing is, in the morning, even if we don't have an aha moment, we might have a sense of how the resolution of that issue might be done. And we think that someone should try and do as much as they can on their own, that whole idea of self-induced and self-devised means, before they actually go and ask someone who may be more versed in this problem that we're having for advice. Oh, it's time. Yes, we have a closing. Speaking of self-induced and self-devised, the multiplication, again, this is from the first message to the American Theosophists. The multiplication of local centers should be a foremost consideration in your minds, and each man should strive to be a center of work in himself. When his inner development has reached a certain point, he will naturally draw those with whom he is in contact under the same influence. A nucleus will be formed around which other people will gather, forming a center from which information and spiritual influence radiate and towards which higher influences are directed. So the meeting is over, and thank you everyone for joining us, and we'll see you on Wednesday.